This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is The Amateur, The Pleasures of Doing What You Love, by Andy Merrifield, out now in paperback. We have lost our amateur spirit and need to rediscover the radical and liberating pleasure of doing things we love. In The Amateur, thinker Andy Merrifield shows us how the many spheres of our lives, work, knowledge, home, politics, have fallen into the hands of box tickers, bean counters, and pedants. In response, he corrals a team of independent thinkers, wayward poets, dabblers and square pegs who challenge accepted wisdom. Such figures as Charles Baudelaire, Fyodor Dostoevsky, Edward Said, Guy Debord, Hannah Arendt, and Jane Jacobs show us the way. As we will see, the amateur takes risks, thinks the unthinkable, seeks independence, and changes the world. The amateur is a passionate manifesto for the liberated life, one that questions authority and reclaims the iconoclast as a radical hero of our times. The Amateur, The Pleasures of Doing What You Love, by Andy Merrifield, out now in paperback from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. That right-wing people in the U.S. and Europe have made George Soros the answer to so many troubling questions is not very surprising. He's a billionaire, he's Jewish, and, unlike most of his cohort, he is an actual intellectual who spends much of his money on substantively progressive causes. But I'd never known much about Soros, save for those few tidbits I just mentioned, until I read Daniel Bessner's essay on him in N+1, which not only sketches out the right's obsessions, but also offers a detailed analysis of Soros as a thinker and philanthropist, coming to the conclusion that Soros's hope for an open and pluralistic society will be forever doomed if we continue to live under the very capitalist system that made Soros so spectacularly rich. What's more, Soros responded with a letter to the editor after Bessner's essay was republished at The Guardian, so we'll talk about that too. But first, before we get rolling, this podcast is supported by podcast listeners like you. It is because listeners donate at patreon.com/thedig that this whole thing is possible. So if you're not supporting The Dig already, but listen to The Dig and like it a bunch, please support us now at patreon.com/thedig. That's patreon.com/thedig. We've got a weekly newsletter for contributions of $5 a month. $10 gets you a copy of either Jacobin's ABCs of Socialism or Assad Hader's Mistaken Identity. And for $20 or more, we have lots of great lefty books to send you. And also, we have a live dig coming up on the left response to the climate crisis in Brooklyn. It's August 17th, 7 p.m. at Verso Books. I've put details in the show notes. Okay, here's Daniel Bessner, a professor of American foreign policy in the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington, and the author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual, published this year by Cornell University Press. Daniel Bessner, welcome to The Dig.
Thanks for having me.
There are now, according to one count, the accuracy of which I have no clue about, roughly 2,700 billionaires in the world. But for the right wing in the U.S. and in Europe, just one of them is truly evil, and that billionaire is George Soros. Who is he? How did he make his money? And what is it about him that not only so exercises the American right, but that has seen him cast as the central villain in Viktor Orban's Hungary?
It's a good question. It's an important question, especially because Soros has become such a figure in our media sphere over the last, really, it seems like he's been there forever, but it's really, I think, only in the early to mid-2000s where he became a public figure, where people who weren't actively engaged in this sort of world of hedge funds or finance, whereas Soros made his money, would be aware of him. So as it indicates, Soros was someone who was born in Hungary in the 30s. His father, who was actually a very well-known Esperantist, sort of Esperanto, the international language, the goal was that it would be at some point everyone's second language. And Soros's father was this big Esperantist, and he changed the family's name from, I believe it was Schwartz, to Soros, which to him had a more sort of internationalist sound, and also, of course, wasn't Jewish, and it wasn't, you know, necessarily that great to be a Jew in Hungary in the 1930s. So Soros and his family, you know, the Holocaust happens, and of course, in the early to mid-1940s, Hungary is invaded by Nazi Germany, and Soros and his family are actually able to go underground, and they survive the Holocaust, and they survive World War II by assuming essentially Christian identities.
And, so, and most Hungarian Jews do not survive.
Yes, most Hungarian Jews do not survive the war. I believe it is 2/3 of Hungary's Jews die in the Holocaust. I'm not exactly sure the exact number, but it's a very, very high amount for the number of Hungarian Jews who die in the Holocaust. So they survive the war, assume Christian identities. And this is the origins of that very strange right-wing myth that Roseanne Barr tweeted out, which was actually the first in the salvo of so-called ambient tweets that eventually got her fired. And she said that George Soros had sold his family out to the Nazis, which of course isn't true and is an anti-Semitic slur. So Soros survives the Holocaust. And in 1947, I believe it was, he leaves Hungary for London to make a career for himself. He eventually enters into the finance world, but not before taking classes at the London School of Economics with a very well-known philosopher, a famous philosopher named Karl Popper. And it's really his encounter with Popper that's the most crucial intellectual experience in Soros's life. Soros experiences, goes to London, meets Popper, eventually gets into finance, and in the 50s moves to New York and becomes a trader, starts one of the biggest hedge funds of all time called, I believe it was, whatever, it doesn't matter. He started one of big hedge funds, makes his the most a very famous trade in 1992. Really a very well-known public figure, even though in the 80s, really I think it was in 79 is when he started his first philanthropic effort. He started it actually in helping out black students in apartheid South Africa, but quickly moves to attempting to create a quote-unquote open society in Eastern Europe, and we could talk about that a bit later. And eventually in the 2000s comes out very much in favor of the Democratic Party. He's very anti-Iraq war and anti the Bush II's foreign policy, and becomes associated with the Democratic Party, and eventually over the next 10 years becomes an anti-Semitic meme on the far right. So that's Soros in capsule biography form.
Is this just plain anti-Semitism, or is it anti-Semitism plus something or somethings else?
I think there's really mostly why Soros in particular has become such a focus on the right wing. I think it has mostly to do with anti-Semitism. I mean, the figure of the banker Jew, or sort of the moneyed Jew, goes back hundreds of years, centuries really, to the medieval period, where Jews were accused of charging interest against Christian people. And there's this long trope in Western thought and Christian thought in particular about Jews sort of ruling the world through money and finance that goes forward to the Rothschild family and then eventually is embodied most recently in George Soros. So I think, yeah, the reason he's such a bugaboo of the right has to do with his Judaism very much, very specifically.
Can you explain a little bit about the distinction between the American right wing portrayal of Soros and this very particular way he is portrayed in Hungary, in the country of his birth?
I think the major difference is in America, it's more subtext, even though the subtext is often pretty obvious. And in Hungary, it might be more text, where, for example, they'll make claims that Soros is trying to undermine Christian Hungary, that he's a foreigner, that he couldn't possibly understand what Hungarians, i.e. Christian Hungarians, truly want, and that Soros is trying to undermine Hungary by allowing basically Muslims into the country by forcing Hungary to give up its Christian heritage. And it's pretty obvious that it's linked to Soros, that the idea is that Soros is an international Jew. It's not quite often stated in the same way on the American right, even though someone like Glenn Beck or Alex Jones, when they create these wild conspiracy theories with Soros at the center, often use barely coded anti-Semitic language of governance and ruling behind the curtains and using money to manipulate good Americans that read good Christian Americans. So there's a lot of similarities there, but I think in Hungary the difference is that it's actively promoted by the president the prime minister rather of Hungary, and in a way that it's still a little fringy on the American right to be so obviously anti-Semitic with Soros, even though we could see how it comes out into the light with Roseanne Barr and her famous Ambien tweets.
And for Orban, does Soros pose a real material, like a substantive material, an ideological threat? Or does he more serve as a useful pretext for Orban's far-right nationalist authoritarian project?
In my opinion, Soros poses no threat to Orban or anything that could really do anything to undermine Hungarian politics. And it's just so interesting, particularly with Orban, because Orban was a major recipient of Soros's aid in the 1990s. I believe he attended university under a grant given by Soros's Open Society Foundations. So it's pretty ironic.
Orban was a young liberal back
in
the day.
Yeah, exactly. A young liberal cum fascist. And so it's pretty ironic that he turned against his previous benefactor. And it says something perhaps pretty interesting about the course of Eastern European politics, or politics in the former Soviet bloc over the course of the 1990s, 2000s, and now 2010s.
I do want to talk about that. But first, you mentioned that Soros went to London, I believe, to study. And something that's distinctive about him, he, like many billionaires, considers himself an intellectual of sorts. That's not unusual. Unlike most, he actually is. Can you explain a little bit what sort of thinking he's steeped in and how it compares to the sort of pablum embraced by most of his counterparts?
So I set out to write this piece on Soros for N+1 because I was basically like, who is this guy? Why did he become this figure, et cetera, et cetera? And I expected to go into it basically saying his ideas were nonsense. He had really not thought about them deeply. He was just surrounded by yes men. Sort of a similar critique to what one might say about Mark Zuckerberg, who has really come out as such an uninteresting and unthoughtful person, or someone like Bill Gates. Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, I'm personally still hoping that he runs for president. I think he's just the right person that we need in this country at this time. But he's really come off, you know, terribly since he was speaking in front of Congress. And it really comes off how he hadn't thought about deeply or really at all about some of the major issues of the technology and the platform that he's created, or even someone like Bill Gates, who basically lists middlebrow authors like Steven Pinker as these brilliant philosophers who really show the world where it's going. I thought we would get something similar with Soros, but he actually is kind of really an intellectual. He's clearly thought very deeply about a lot of very complex issues, and he oftentimes, and this was quite, you know, surprising to me in a good way, I guess I would say, is that he oftentimes has had pretty good politics, in the sense that particularly during the early 2000s, during the Iraq War, he was very much against Bush's expansionist imperialist foreign policy from the get-go in a very good way. And even in the 1990s, he's very skeptical and critical of what he called market fundamentalism, and what market fundamentalism, what I essentially think he means by that is sort of hyper-capitalist neoliberalism, in the ways in which it could undermine society. And I was completely not expecting this from, you know, obviously a billionaire who is in this grotesque, who earned a grotesque amount of money.
As another point on that front, he is by far and away, as far as I know, one of the largest funders of organizations fighting the drug war in the United States. And that is a pretty unusual philanthropic focus compared to, you know, Gates funding, you know, just
malaria,
malaria eradication projects, or all the various rich people who fund neoliberal school reform.
Right. I mean, Soros is great on certain issues. He's great on the drug war. He's great on sex work, actually. Recently, the Open Society Foundation has started a project to help normalize sex work and basically to decriminalize and eventually legalize it. As far as I understand, that's what they want to do. And he's also really good on prosecutorial reform. He, for example, contributed to the campaign of Philadelphia's Larry Krasner.
An independent expenditure on that in support of that campaign to be nitpick.
No, please. Nitpick away. We want to be accurate about that. So he's actually good on certain issues. I mean, in my opinion, he doesn't particularly understand the dynamics of capitalism very well. And there are some other significant blind spots in his thought. But I was actually rather surprised about how thoughtful he was about certain of these issues.
Explain a little bit about his intellectual influences and what his foundation is called, the Open Society Foundation. What is this open society that he endeavors to construct, and what's his theory of how such a transformation comes about?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, Soros went to the London School of Economics and he took classes with this Austrian emigre philosopher named Karl Popper. Now Popper came of age very famously in quote unquote Red Vienna, in socialist Vienna, in the 30s. He was born in 1902, I believe, and you know, developed. He was a young communist, eventually becomes a liberal. Popper started his career as a philosopher of science, but he became most known for a 1945 book that he wrote, The Open Society and Its Enemies. And what Popper was essentially trying to figure out, at least in my opinion, was he was trying to figure out what is the place for assimilated and secular Jews like him in an ethno-nationalist world. So Popper was born into a political formation called, as many of the listeners to The Dig no doubt know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And for many Jews, after the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed in World War I, this was really the high point of political organization, because in this Austrian Empire, they believed that there was a philosophy called cosmopolitanism, or really a philosophy that was given a name by Popper called cosmopolitanism. And the idea was that you could have various identities coexisting in a city like Vienna, or in a nation or an empire like Austria-Hungary, and that even though that everyone had their own private beliefs, they could come out into public and they could engage with each other as equals. And this was a cosmopolitan society, or what Popper would term the open society. So Soros is
in other words, the solution to the Jewish question, to Marx's
exactly.
Jewish
so
question.
Popper's exactly. So Hitler's solution to the Jewish question was to kill everyone. Popper's solution to the Jewish question was to basically establish an open society where Jews would be able to have their own private beliefs and would be able to have their own particularistic ethnic and religious identities, but nonetheless be able to participate in society as equals. So in essence, that was Popper's solution to the so-called Jewish question, the Judenfrage. Now, Soros encountered Popper, and he was really startled by his brilliance, by his sort of anti-charisma, in a sense, and he basically became an intellectual acolyte of Popper's. It's a little unclear to me how close they were. They certainly met each other a number of times, but I'm not sure how much Popper knew about Soros. But Soros definitely modeled himself on Popper, or at least modeled his personal philosophy on Popper, on the idea that the best one can do is create an open society. Now, of course, what is the opposite of an open society? It is a closed society. And what are the two paradigmatic examples of closed societies, Dan? I'm sure you'll be surprised to hear.
Fascism and behind the Iron Curtain.
Exactamente. So on one hand, fascism was the ultimate closed society, and that's really what Popper had in mind when he was writing The Open Society and Its Enemies in exile. Originally, he went to New Zealand before World War two, I believe, and then eventually, like very many intellectuals and people across the political spectrum throughout what might be broadly termed the West, between the 1945 and the 1950s, he began to transfer his anxieties about fascism onto what was considered the quote unquote totalitarian Soviet Union. And I think just for Digg listeners, I just want to emphasize how critical this analogy is to understanding post-1945 liberalism. Because before World War II, there's a very much a liberal fascination with the Soviet Union. You see it in the late 20s and the early 30s. And this continues to...
And this is part of the Popular Front era.
Yes, the Popular Front era. And it begins to end really with the Moscow trials of 36, 37, though it continues to a degree, but it really ends between 45 and 50, and it ends at different points for different people. And we could talk about that later. I go into it in my own book, Democracy in Exile. But just the important thing to note here is that the analogy of Soviet communism or Bolshevism with Nazi Germany and fascism under the rubric of quote-unquote totalitarianism is really critical for understanding why liberals agree to fight a Cold War, because they view the Soviet Union really as an existential threat that was very much analogous to the Nazis. And Popper and sort of books like The Open Society and Its Enemies were critical means by which intellectuals helped promote this transition from emergency during World War II to permanent emergency during the Cold War. And it's this idea that Soros really imbibes under Popper at the LSE.
How is it that Soros translates this philosophy of open societies into a program that he's funding with huge amounts of money?
So, well, of course, he has to make his money. So Soros eventually at some point has to make a choice whether he's going to be a PhD student in philosophy or whether he's going to try to make money on the equivalent of Wall Street in London and then, of course, in New York itself. And he eventually decides that for whatever reason, I would like to get access to his papers to figure out why exactly he makes this choice, but he decides to go into finance. So over the course of the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, he begins to really make his money on Wall Street, particularly through hedge fund trading. And Soros always claims, again, it's difficult to know without actually looking at contemporary documents, but that his philosophy really helped him understand, or his philosophical leanings really helped him understand the ways the markets would move. And he actually does turn out to be a pretty great financial trader, and he makes a ton of money. But what's really interesting is by the late 1970s, Soros has this interesting quote where he essentially says, I decided I made too much money. I had made enough money. I don't need to worry about it. And I could actually do what I really want to do with my life, which is try to create open societies the world over. So what he does is he founds philanthropy in the late 70s. Again, initially he works in apartheid South Africa, but quickly moves to Eastern Europe, where he does things like promote fellowships for Eastern Europeans to travel to the West, where he funds Xerox machines so people could spread ideas throughout the populace, and these various other behaviors, these non-governmental behaviors that he wants to do is sort of open what he considers the closed societies of the Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe. And he becomes a really influential figure during this moment with helping open the areas behind the Iron Curtain, which to my mind is not a bad thing. I think we on the left could be free to criticize oppression and lack of particular freedoms, such as freedom of speech, freedom of association, etc. So he does these things.
They could definitely use some copying machines.
Yes, definitely use that. So this is what he does in the 1980s. And he becomes, and this is really critical for understanding the memory of Soros in Eastern Europe and also in Russia. So for many Eastern Europeans now, today, Soros is an example of Western interference into their sovereign territory, which is why one of the many reasons he's receiving such pushback throughout what might be called the former Eastern Bloc.
Which is ironic because the very right-wing forces that are accusing him of being this outside agitator intervening in Central and Eastern Europe were, in Orban's case, the very same people who were benefiting from the movement against totalitarian communism, you know, as it was understood that he was funding back in the day.
Yeah, exactly.
It's weird.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it just shows sort of the complexities of post-Soviet, post-Cold War Eastern European politics, and really the whole history of Central Eastern Europe, or what was called, I think it was called after the Cold War, you start getting all these people writing about East Central Europe as its own territory. Middle Europa is a way that it's sometimes referred to in German, and sort of the complexities of these former imperial territories, essentially, whether they were former Russian territories or the former Austro-Hungarian territories, and that were created into nation states over the course of the early 20th century. So we're basically still working out these very fundamental problems in Eastern Europe of nationalism and identity and what it means to be a nation state in this, what might be, I think, legitimately be called a post-imperial context.
The upshot of your essay is that Soros has invested a lot intellectually and a lot more financially into creating a certain type of world that he thinks of as the open society, and the very opposite of that world seems to be ascendant all over the place with the rise of xenophobic, militarist, bigoted far right. And I want to quote from your essay. You write, "While Soros recognized earlier than most the limits of hypercapitalism, his class position made him unable to advocate the root and branch, read anti or post-capitalist, reforms necessary to bring about the world he desires. The system that allows George Soros to accrue the wealth that he has proven to be a system in which cosmopolitanism will never find a stable home." Explain your argument about the fundamental contradiction between the economic system that Soros believes in, even though he believes in a fairly restrained version of capitalism, on the one hand, and on the other hand, this social reality that he wants to create.
Right. And so this is, I think, a really interesting element in what might be called Jewish intellectual thought that goes back to the 19th century. And it's the idea that capitalism is actually good for the Jews, because in a capitalist society, you could engage just through market exchanges, right? People don't care what your ethnic identity is. They care that you have this good, and they care that you're able to sell to them at a good price. So this is, I think, a strong, so you have very influential Jewish left-wing thinkers. Of course, the entire Frankfurt School, Marx is a very influential left-wing thinker. I don't know if you've heard of him. But there's also this strand about the Jewish confrontation with modernity, and particularly with Christian anti-Semitism, that ethno-nationalism, that thinks that capitalism is a means to create a cosmopolitan society in which Jews will find a home. But I think what's happened is that Soros, at least, hasn't recognized that the contradictions inherent in capitalism itself cannot simply be overcome with more regulation or basically a personal commitment to doing good. And I think Soros's major failure comes in the fact that when people he says this often in his books, that people should interact in the market basically ruthlessly. They should search only for their own self-interests. But when it comes to politics and voting, they should take the interests of society into a whole. So basically what Soros wants to do is create a firewall between economic activity and political activity, which in my opinion, at least, is personally a very naive way of understanding how people actually interact in the world and the connections between economic and political cultures. So ultimately, Soros is not really able to come out against capitalism, even though at certain moments he seems on the edge of it. For example, at one point, he says the connection between capitalism and democracy is, a quote, I believe the quote is tenuous at best. He's never able to come out against capitalism full stop. And that's because, and which I think is his major intellectual failing at this point, because it's become very clear that capitalism tends towards extremes. Yeah, as Marx predicted 150 years ago, it tends towards capital accumulation, and which necessarily tends towards political stability and the sorts of racism and xenophobia and ethno-nationalism ultimately that we're seeing rise in the United States and elsewhere throughout the world. And I think this is really his fundamental problem. It's not hyper-capitalism, it's capitalism. And I think Soros is really never able to make that leap, probably for a variety of contingent historical reasons, and of course is the fact that he's a billionaire, right? Ultimately,
that might be the most contingent reason of all, the billion plus that he is in possession of.
Right, The billionaires are never going to be able to really come out against capitalism, which is a real problem again with our society when it's so governed by this small cadre of Musk's, Davos's, Zuckerberg's, Gates's, Bezos, Soros's, etc. Is that they're never going to be able to advocate the reforms that are necessary, and this is why sort of the whole philanthropic capitalism and liberal obsession, or with the idea of the good billionaire, is really, in my opinion, faulty. Because at this particular moment, they're just not the people we need to look to for leadership, either political leadership, economic leadership, cultural leadership, what have you.
Is the correct materialist assessment of the shortcomings in George Soros's political philosophy that philosophy is fundamentally idealist rather than materialist because of his material conditions?
Exactly. And I think that's a really great way of putting it. And what I argued in the article is that he ultimately sees ideas as driving history. So he's very much not a materialist. He doesn't see the connection, or I think he doesn't see it as enough as he possibly could, about how material conditions necessarily shape one's ideology and one's ideas. Now, I'm not a pure historical materialist. I think ideas and material interact in sort of a very complex relationship going back and forth, where ideas affect material, material affects ideas, et cetera, et cetera. But for Soros—
So does Marx in the 18th Brumaire.
Yeah, so does Marx. There's a good pedigree there. And this is what's funny when you go into sort of examining Marx, like his writings are the Bible. You know, there's contradictions, there's tensions, et cetera, et cetera. And many people in the 20s and the 30s spent their lives doing that. But I think that's really the problem with his view. Ideas don't always drive history, and they don't drive history in the way that he assumes. And also, he, I think, has a very naive understanding of how politics actually work.
Soros responded to your essay. It was initially published in N+1 and then republished in The Guardian. And he responded with a letter to the editor in The Guardian, respectfully taking issue with your piece. He seemed sincerely appreciative of what is truly like a fair, generous, and very substantive engagement with who he is as a person and a philanthropist and a businessman. But the issue he took was that he said that he has in fact been a, quote, steadfast promoter of, quote, root and branch reforms. Lay out what you saw as the core of Soros' response and what you make of it.
It's actually a pretty interesting methodological question for historians when they – this is one of the problems or one of the difficulties or tensions in oral history, or relying on historical actors themselves to evaluate their own actions in the past. They're useful tools sometimes, but really you need to go back to the contemporary documents. But with this particular issue about the root and branch reforms, I think we would disagree as to what root and branch would be. I think that we need to replace capitalism or capitalist society or the capitalist political economy. You could get more specific and less abstract with a socialist vision of the world, where ultimately ownership and private property and capital are totally reimagined, and the relationship between a person and his society is completely reimagined, particularly the relationship to the political economy. Soros never advocated that. I think Soros, what he said as root, what he would take to be root and branch reforms, or sort of the hyper-capitalism, which he did of the 1990s, of the post-Cold War era, the deregulation spur of the Clinton administration, the repealing of Glass-Steagall. And Soros did, to be fair, criticize those. But again, this is what's so interesting, is that it's not hyper-capitalism, it's capitalism itself. A kinder, gentler capitalism doesn't exist. And we know that because we actually have a historical period where capitalism didn't have any constraints. For most of the second half of the 20th century, capitalism had an existential enemy or perceived existential enemy in Soviet communism. And Soviet communism, as many historians have demonstrated, forced capitalists to essentially come to some sort of compromise, what Aziz Rana in N+1 calls a Cold War compromise with the left, where the left was essentially able to, and labor in particular, was essentially able to keep its gains as long as it agreed to fight a Cold War. So basically, Soviet communism, it appears in retrospect, kept the worst aspects of capitalism some sort of check. But absent that existential threat, you know, the post-1991 world, capitalism, as Marx predicted, as many other people predicted, again, tends to accumulate wealth, tends to lead to income inequality. And so that's how we could see that, again, it's not hyper-capitalism of the time that Soros rightfully decries. I mean, we should all decry that. Every thinking person should decry that. But it's capitalism itself. And he was never able to see beyond the vision of the system that he had totally dominated and from which he was an enormous benefactor. From which he benefited enormously. And benefited to such a degree that it's almost impossible to imagine the amount of wealth that George Soros has. It's really impossible to imagine. And there, to me, at least, I assume to everyone who's listening to this, it's a sign of a sick society that someone is allowed, and I use that word advisedly, allowed, that society has allowed this person to accrue that much wealth. It's really problematic and indicative of a very sick way of living in the world and organizing a political economy.
I think the reason that your careful, close, considerate evaluation of Soros is so revealing is because you're looking at the shortcomings of easily the best billionaire philanthropist who capitalism has ever produced.
Exactly. And that's what's interesting, and that's what's surprising and compelling about Soros. I mean, I think he's really such a sign of the age that I think people are actually going to be studying him for quite a bit. As I put it in the article,
he's a good person.
Yeah. He's not like a piece of shit. You know, he actually gives his money to like causes you and I would promote. I mean, also we're anti-malarial, but Soros like really, we're not in favor. The Dig has a strong anti-malaria stance.
Speak for yourself, Bessner.
Oh God, big malaria has gotten to you too. But anyway, the point is that Soros, I don't think he's a bad person. I think he really does want the world to be more equal, and he's given his money to causes. But the problem is that doesn't matter, is that in capitalism, you're not able to make the sorts of reforms or the types of reforms that he is advocating and that he has promoted. You could change at the margins, but ultimately the system is going to turn against the mass of people as it's done from the beginning and as it continues to do today. But this is, I do think it's important on the left, at least sort of left intellectuals who examine this issue, to take the best of liberalism and examine it and really take it on its own terms to see what its failures are. In my opinion, that's really one of the best ways to build a defense against it and to ensure that people aren't, you know, tricked again, for lack of a better phrase, or ongoingly tricked into believing in the system which has failed so many people.
Yeah, it seems a lot more productive than just sniping at Neera Tanden on Twitter.
I think people like Soros give a better understanding of what people in the system and what people who support the system want to believe about it. And by exposing the various contradictions inherent in people like Soros's thought or people like Soros's action, you're really able to get a better understanding of what the system is.
Well, Daniel Bessner, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks so much, Dan. It was really fun.
Daniel Bessner is a professor of American foreign policy in the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington, and the author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier in the Rise of the Defense Intellectual, published this year by Cornell University Press. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that humans do make their own history, but certainly not in conditions of their own choosing, however much they might wish that were the case. While other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week, usually twice a week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get podcasts, and subscribe. If it's on iTunes, please do leave us a nice review. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners. What also does that is you telling your friends about the show. Please make propaganda for us. And find us at patreon.com/thedig and make a monthly contribution to help keep this operation going. Even a few bucks is a big help.